Welcome to the Mental Training Lab. I'm Pete Kadushin, your host, and my job is to have fun conversations that leave you with actionable tools, little experiments that will help you improve your mindset and mental skills so that you can do the things you love at a higher level. Today, we're going to do something different. After Jean dropped by the show to share her experience as a musician, we realized that there was a ton of ground we still hadn't covered. So today, we're actually switching seats, and she's going to interview me. I'm not going to bore you with my own introduction, and instead, here's what we get into in part one of the conversation. We touch on the nature of flow and the triggers that we can engineer into pre-performance to help find flow more often. We discuss practical embodiment and spend a lot of time thinking about how to balance challenge and skill, both in practice and performance contexts. And although many of the examples we use are grounded in music, Jean does a great job of pushing me to talk sports as well. Here we go for part one. I hope you enjoy. Jean, welcome back to the Mental Training Lab for what is going to be the first time that I take my hands off the steering wheel and relinquish control. You're actually going to interview me today.
I'm very excited to dive into what I think musicians could gain from your position.
Well, and so I can't let go entirely. So I'll open the proceedings with a question, and then hopefully that sets the stage for everything that comes after. I'm curious from your perspective, if there are differences, key differences between performing as an athlete and performing as a musician, and you know, then we'll kind of dive into the rest of it from there.
I, of course, don't know what it's like to perform as a professional athlete or even a very high performance athlete. I did sports through high school and that's about it. But I imagine the crossover is enormous when it comes to mental performance and mental training, because adrenaline directly impacts both probably equally. I play trumpet, I'm a brass player. And so my respiratory system and how it functions is enormously important for making actual sound. And I'm sure cognitively the same instances, or I'm sure cognitively the same ideas flow through my head and the same worries, and they manifest in the same ways. I think if there is a difference, it's what the focus might be, where I'm trying to quiet my mind so that I can focus on the music making and the art. And I think that could probably relate greatly to a gymnastics routine or a figure skating routine where there's an element of being expressive. But I'm not sure how that crossover would exist in all sports as a large umbrella category. What do you think?
I like that you brought up the specific demands as opposed to just assuming that musicianship and being an athlete are somehow different because, you know, there's no score on the scoreboard when you're finished. I think that it really comes back to what are you actually being asked to do? And, you know, everybody has the same hardware in terms of the way their brain works and how their brain interfaces with their body. And so there are going to be thoughts, there's going to be feelings, they're going to impact your behavior. And so something like a gymnastics where there's a routine and that routine is graded based on perfection, essentially. But there's also that expressive and aesthetic piece. You know, how did you make the judges feel? I think there's more crossover there than, let's say, a football or a hockey or a basketball where there's a whole team and there's certainly score, but it's not graded on perfection. It's just graded on volume at that point. There's probably different demands depending on the type of music you play. And so you pointed out in the last episode we did that you're playing jazz versus playing classical, very different. And so maybe jazz, particularly in a group, would be more like the basketballs or the footballs, where there's some set plays, but there's also a lot of improv in between. Whereas classical would be much more like a dance or a gymnastics.
Yeah, exactly. And I think something that is interesting about music is sometimes you're performing and people are paying for the art of the music. So you have a pressure to show up and deliver that art. But other times, in order to get into a position where you are offering that art to the public, you have to audition for a spot or audition for a competition. And those do have scores, because maybe they don't rate you from, you know, 0 to 100, but in a professional orchestra audition, for example, there's a couple rounds. And so you show up, you play your prelim round, and it's behind a screen. They don't see you, so they're trying to avoid as many biases as they can. But then you advance, and they advance only a select number of people. And then when you advance, you're put into the second round, and so on. And so there's this athletic element of winning. And the end goal is to just perform the art that you have prepared, but it's also to win. And I don't think anybody gets second place in an orchestra audition and said, yes, I am a silver medalist. No, you don't say that. You say, that person won the job. I didn't. I just happened to play very well and they liked them better. So, and then in competitions, it's the same thing. You're on display and you're receiving scores. And so we do have to balance those two things. And actually, those two things are really detrimental to each other sometimes. If you only think about the art and you don't think about the mental performance side of preparation and what it's going to be like when I'm really on the spot and there's a big weight to not winning, that has a really different psychological effects. So I don't know if we can find any sports that relate to that component of music making.
Well, I think that an interesting thing that just came up was that, you know, there's a collaborative aspect to making music, but there's also a number of scenarios that are very competitive. And in most sports, there's a competitive quality to it, right? That there's very few sports where it's just go out, create your art, and then let that rest. It's always, almost always, hierarchically ranked against somebody else. And so that maybe is a distinction between the pure arts and then the athletic arts. But I think, you know, knowing actors and knowing musicians, that the audition portion of it often feels like a big game or a championship. And there is a very clear cut, I either got it or I didn't. And like you pointed out, there's not a whole lot of satisfaction that comes with, well, I played really well. That was, I expressed myself, right? But I didn't get the job. The other thing that I'm thinking about, though, is that you pointed that maybe mental performance and the expression of creativity and art maybe aren't always aligned. And I think that at least the way I try and approach it is that, what are we tuning your mental performance to? So maybe we use the skills aimed in a way for a competition that are slightly different than how you might do it if you were just performing and people were coming to see your show. Right? But that it's still all mental performance, because we're still trying to accomplish a certain state when the music starts and then maintaining a certain state through that performance, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the state, I think a lot of people call it the state of flow, is what we're trying to enter. When you're playing a hockey game or basketball game, how much do you recommend that athletes stay in this state of flow? And do you recommend they purposefully leave it at times? We talked a little bit about this last time, but I'm curious what it's like from an athletic perspective.
I think that flow is a double-edged sword, or being in the zone, because it's the state in which you are so immersed in the activity that there's really no longer a boundary between you and the activity. So for that moment, you hear a lot of people talk about it, like, I blacked out for that period of time. I don't really remember, or I remember and it feels like everything got super stretched out. I had all the time in the world. So there's a lot of really interesting things that happen, but flow is generally marked by high level performance, right? You're playing it at your best. And although it doesn't feel good in the moment, because you can't really have a recognition of the feeling, you're so immersed that there isn't that layer of, man, this is really cool. But then immediately afterwards, you go, oh my God, that was awesome. So that's all one side of the double-edged sword. The other side is that if we wait to perform our best until we're in flow, then we're setting ourselves up for disappointment because it's not going to happen every single performance. And so the way that I try and navigate that with athletes and the way I think about it within the context of musicians as well is that we want to be doing several key things to get closer to flow. Right? And whether it shows up or it doesn't, we put ourselves in the best possible space to perform our best. And so really trying to aim for 3 or 4 triggers. The first is deep embodiment. And so we talk a lot about getting from the neck down because a lot of performers have spent so much time thinking, and this is something that came up in our first call, right? So much time thinking that you think now that the way to continue to improve or perform your best is just to think your way through it some more. If some is good, more is better. And that eventually manifests itself as being stuck and stuck specifically from the neck up. And so that deep embodiment, being able to get out of your head and into your felt experience while the performance is happening. And not to think, you know, not to shut down thinking entirely, but to allow yourself to only think as much as necessary and then the rest be within the body. So that's one of the big levers. Another one is grounding in the present moment. And I think embodiment and present moment focus generally come together. It's hard to be in your body and in your felt experience some other time. Right? By definition, at that point, you're thinking about it as opposed to feeling it. And then the last one that I really aim for is finding a way to balance challenge and skill. And it's not absolute challenge and skill. It's really about your perception of your skill and how that matches up to the challenge. And what's interesting is that a lot of the more recent flow research has shown that you want just a little bit more challenge than your perception of skill. And so the number that I've seen is 4% harder. And some of the reason why that's the case is because you want your physiology to rise to the challenge, right? If your skill far outpaces the challenge, you kind of get bored or a little too relaxed, and it's really tough to bring your full attention to the experience. If the challenge is 25% harder, that's your oh shit experience. And now it feels like a saber-toothed tiger is right over your shoulder. And now your fight or flight has kind of run away. Your sympathetic nervous system is way too cranked up. And so then working with performers around that, we're trying to find a way to accurately represent their skill and then think about the challenge in a way that allows it to feel tough without feeling overwhelming. When you put all of those together, you kind of have the table set for flow, but you've also put yourself in a position where if you don't drop into the zone, you're still going to have a mindset that's going to allow you to perform your best anyway.
So I'm hearing you say what it sounds like is that the zone is sort of like a muse that shows up or it doesn't.
There's things we can do to make it way more likely that flow will show up to dinner, right? But there's no guarantee. You can't just press the button and drop into the zone. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe at some point in the future, we're going to have headgear that electrically stimulates different regions of the brain to immediately put you into a state of flow. And until that happens, and maybe somewhere out there, people are already doing that. Right? But until that happens, right, you kind of set the table, you do those three things. There's some environmental triggers that we can look for as well. And then really it's about following a cycle that makes it likely. So that first part of the cycle is a little bit of overwhelm. So this is useful for all the athletes and performers who are like, I don't feel great right now, right? I perform in 5 minutes and I've got butterflies. Well, it turns out that stressing the system is actually the first stage in triggering the neurobiological cascade that engages flow. But the important piece that everybody tends to miss is that we actually then need to relax and drop in from the top. It used to be that we would coach performers to work their way up to their sweet spot, right? So be more relaxed through warm up and then tune yourself up. I actually heard somebody once talk about it like a guitar. You would never tune down to get to the right tuning. You would always want to tune up to keep the tension there. It turns out that for flow, you really want the opposite. You want to be a little too crispy, and then you want to, you know, let your shoulders drop. You want to relax a little bit, and that actually drops you through the skylight into flow. And so there's that stress and that overwhelm. There's the release. And then the third stage is now you're in flow, right? You're immersed in the activity. The boundary between you and the thing is so thin that it's essentially just doing the doing, right? The music is playing itself. And then the fourth stage is sort of the come down and the reintegration back into regular life, where you're like, what just happened? Which can be both pleasant and also a little bittersweet, because you've now come down off the mountain and you remember what it was like up there, but you can't live on the top of the mountain forever.
That's so interesting, because I've learned how to set myself up, or as you would say, arrive at ready, but I really have to wait until my first breath and my first note before I know whether or not it's flow. It's because the nerves and adrenaline are there and very active, and they have been detrimental to my performance in the past, but also the times I've experienced that moment of being in the zone, I felt the same butterfly sensation to a very large degree. And it's not like there's a moment of like, oh, it's here. It's like, I'm not even aware that it's here, but it just immediately, I walk through the flow door, or I walk through a door of like, okay, so now there's a mental component that I am going to have to work with. And I, at least I've learned how to do that for myself through a lot of experience. I'm really interested in what you said about the 4%, because I have a degree in music education, and we talk about the zone of proximity, proximal zone, where you're providing content to students that is right in that sweet spot of just a little bit too hard for them, so that it's just beyond their grasp but reachable within the haze and the fog of all that we don't know. Can you talk more about that and how you instruct and help people to discover what that 4% is for them?
I love that you brought up the learning and growth process as well, because what excites me about mental training is that if we have two jobs, which is to get better as fast as we can and then be able to take those lessons and put them into play under pressure, then I'm really thinking about the optimal states being flow for that second job, that being able to perform under pressure. And then the principles of deliberate practice being sort of the optimal state when we think about that training mindset. And what's exciting is that everything I just described, the deep embodiment, the present moment focus, a clear target for what we're trying to accomplish. Well, I left that one out the first time, but that's important for flow too. You can't show up and be in flow if you're like, I don't know what we're actually trying to do. But all of those carry over. They're manifested a little bit differently in training or in rehearsal or performance or practice, but they're all still really important. And then certainly the balance of challenge and skill is critical as well. One of the exciting things, so I've been listening to a lot of the Huberman Lab podcast, and Dr. Andrew Huberman. We were talking about his dog Costello before we hit record, and he's a professor of neuroscience and ophthalmology, and he talks a lot about the optimal state for your nervous system to be in order to engage in neuroplasticity, which is learning that conformationally changes the brain. And one of the hallmarks is that you have to be activated and alert, and then you need to be deeply focused. And so challenge that's just a little bit harder than what you think you're currently capable of is going to activate you without overactivating you. Right, alert without being totally overwhelmed. And then it's going to demand that you focus in a way that you might not if it's a passage that you've played so many times that you can do it with your eyes closed and half asleep. And so to your actual question, which was, how do I help athletes find that space, or performers in general? A lot of times, if I have the opportunity, it's collaborating with them and their skill coach or their head coach. Because there's a lot of sports that I'm not the expert on. In fact, I would argue that I'm not an expert on any sport. And so it's being able to work with that human who is an expert in their own experience within the context of their sport. And then hopefully another set of outside eyes that knows kind of the course of development for that person. And from there, it's really about tuning in and building awareness for that performer to say, okay, well, if rehearsal didn't go well today, was it, let's troubleshoot. Was it that you weren't able to bring the right amount of energy? Right? So you were underactivated. Were you a little overwhelmed because, you know, there's a couple days before performance and you don't feel like that passage, the really tough one, is exactly where it should be. And so you actually got too cranked up during rehearsal, and then you get frustrated because it's not going well and things get tighter. Was it an error in attention, or did we just set you up to fail because I threw the bar way up too high and you're just not there yet? And then each time you screw up, you're just more and more frustrated. And so I think a lot of it comes back to reflecting with purpose and with structure and figuring out, if today didn't go exactly the way I wanted to, let's work through the checklist and identify what potential errors showed up. And if it comes back to that challenge skill balance, then it's up to that athlete sometimes to advocate to their coach, say, hey coach, can we back that up? Or can we stay after practice and work on that specific piece? Because maybe my footwork, it still doesn't feel totally clear what you're asking me to do. Or this new skill, I'm just not quite figuring it out. But a lot of it comes down to after the facting and then engineering that into the next opportunity to train.
And when you reflect, I think about this a lot, and I thought about this a lot after our last conversation. Do you ever reflect purposefully through different lenses? For example, when I have a practice session, let's say it's 20 minutes long, or 20 minutes is like a segment within a larger practice session, I find it beneficial to say, what didn't work and why didn't it work? And then the why is, what was my physical skill not where it needed to be? Am I far below that 4%? Is my mental skill not where it needs to be? In terms of music, it's hearing the music inside your head. If I can't do that, I have to work on my ear without my instrument. Then there's the physical efficiency and the mental / emotional efficiency, which is actually my physical skill. I know I could do that, but I was really tense in the back of my neck. And so that inhibits my breathing, which inhibits my performance. And then the mental skill is, you know, if there's something else on my mind that keeps chirping in, or if I, maybe I'm more of a morning person and I'm having a late night practice, and that's going to affect the productive part of my practice. And also, I find it beneficial to reflect through those four lenses. Do you ever do that with athletes as well? And are there more factors to consider with other folks?
What you're getting at, I think, or at least the way that I'm translating it in my own mind, is that we really don't want to try and remember all the stuff as you're sitting down. And more likely, a lot of folks don't have structured reflection. They just, after the fact, go, I don't know, it was like kind of ugh. And there's no sense of, well, what categories do I want to examine closer? And I think that, you know, brains are great at problem solving, but they're terrible at remembering. And so we'll just worry a problem or worry our experience from last night's rehearsal or the performance and kind of spin on it. And for you, it's clear that you know which four categories you're going to investigate. And you, even if that's not written down in a checklist someplace, you know that you move from category to category to understand both, hopefully, both what went well and enabled you to perform at a high level or rehearse and grow at a high level. But then certainly what may have gotten in the way and kinked the hose a little bit to prevent you from that unobstructed self-expression that we're really working towards. And so with athletes, you know, you want to make sure that there's a similar structure to it. And so helping them think through, did I prepare ineffectively? And then if we zoom in on the preparation, was it a poor night's sleep? Did I not recover effectively? Did I not eat well? So was my blood sugar too high, too low? Was I just heavy because I decided to like go to the buffet and hammer it before practice? And so there's all sorts of the lifestyle factors that you want to investigate. And then certainly within the context of the imminent performance or practice, what did your pre-performance routine look like? Did you warm your body up? Did you warm your mind up? Did you arrive at practice, the start of practice, at ready? Same thing with a game. And then was it a breakdown in reflection? Did you not know what you were going to do better today because you didn't reflect well yesterday? And so I guess the long answer was that. The short answer is yes, I think that it behooves any performer to really have clarity around which categories they want to investigate. Because if you're just reinventing the wheel every time you sit down to reflect, you're wasting time and you're going to miss stuff. Because when we're in particularly when things haven't gone well, and we're in sort of that mini mind, because a lot of our bandwidth is being consumed with frustration, disappointment, shame, guilt, etc., we're not going to remember to look at the obvious stuff, like, oh, I didn't drink any water before practice. That's why I sucked. Well, next time I can fix that. That doesn't have to be a really complicated world-ending experience. You just drink some more water.
Right. I think differentiating between everything that could have gone wrong that led to the problem is tough for me, at least, because there's so much that goes on in the mind and body that affect what we do. I'm really curious to talk more about the deep embodiment portion of performance and preparation. Could you elaborate more on that, and then also maybe offer some concrete skills that, or concrete action steps that help people discover how to focus on everything below the head?
Yeah, it's a great question. When we're thinking about embodiment, the challenging piece here, and I think this comes up a lot with meditation in general, is that we're so used to thinking about what we're feeling, whether that's emotions or physical sensations, right? Our five senses, that it's really hard at first to realize that I'm not actually feeling something. I'm thinking about what's happening. And there's this really subtle layer of thought film that kind of covers our whole experience. And so I think this is why consistent meditation practice is really powerful to begin with, is because it starts to peel out, you know, if the target is your breath, well, that's a physical sensation. Where do you feel it, and what does it feel like? What does the air taste like? What do you hear as you're breathing? As opposed to then noticing, oh, I'm thinking about that breath, and I'm going, that's an okay breath. I could probably have a better breath. Or why does my chest feel so tight? It's not going as deep as I thought. And so I think step one in terms of purposefully embodying is starting to peel that layer of thought off simply by setting yourself up to practice being embodied. So it doesn't have to be your breath. You could pick doing the dishes, brushing your teeth, anything that reliably happens on a regular basis, because that allows you to tether this practice to a habit that already exists. But the idea being that if I'm doing the dishes, I want to be with the feelings that come with that. And then notice when I drift back into my mind, and then just bring my attention back to the experience of doing the dishes. What does the soap feel like? What does the sponge feel like? What do I hear as the water hits the bottom of the sink? And it's the practice of doing that over and over again that allows us to have the control of our attentional spotlight and bring it back to physical sensation as opposed to the thoughts that are associated with it. Mm. I think the second piece of the puzzle is that oftentimes when we arrive in our bodies, because we've spent so much time away, we don't really like what we find, right? Like if I do this right now, if I just pause for a second and notice what's happening in my body, my right shoulder's tense, my lower back hurts, my hips are really tight. And all of a sudden I'm like, well, why would I hang out here? And so the initial inclination then is to just jump right back into thought, because this doesn't feel like a great place to hang out. And so this is why I think practices like yoga nidra or yoga in general, to create that relationship that's accepting and non-judgmental within the context of exploring, but also strengthening and adding to the flexibility of your body, can be really powerful. And there are certainly some scripts that you can listen to that lead you through your body either as a body scan or yoga nidra scripts that allow you to begin to understand what it feels like to be embodied and relaxed, so that you don't have that moment where you drop into your body just for a moment and then vanish again because, man, that's like, my shoulder hurts, my neck hurts, my jaw is a little tight. And for those who are listening right now, we could do that right now. It doesn't have to be more complicated than, you know, bring your attention to the contact of your butt on whatever you're sitting on. Don't think about it. Just bring your awareness to what it feels like to have gravity pressing you into the seat. And if you're standing or walking and listening to this, you just do the same with the soles of your feet. And you'll notice. And then almost invariably, you will bounce right back out and start thinking about it and going, well, am I doing it right? This is kind of stupid, or whatever else is in your head. And then you could just bring your attention gently back. And the magic, non-magic to controlling your attention is that you really just, it's that. It's choosing to pay attention and bring something to conscious awareness. And so I don't know if I fully answered your question. And if you have follow-ups, let's do it.
I was just noticing my butt on the chair.
Yeah, that'll happen.
I got a little lost in that sensation. No, I think you did answer the question really well. And you did provide a very clear, concise action step, which is awesome. And I know you talked a little bit about that in your awareness episode, where you went into a deep dive. Maybe that's, you can correct me if I'm wrong. But I remember you saying a few of these techniques about awareness, body awareness, being in your five senses. This is a little bit of a shifting of gears, but I forget who you had. I think it may have been one of your interviewers or interviewees, and they were talking about long distance running. Maybe it was Amy, and how it's a beautiful thing because, yes, physiologically, we inherit certain DNA that affects our performance, and the physical component is a very real part of it. But there's also this mental component, and we all have the same ingredients. And I found myself wondering and interested to learn more on that. What part of the mental ingredients do we inherit? And maybe this is a little bit off the cuff, but do we all truly have access to the same techniques coming from the same entry point? Or is there also an inherited trait in your thought process? Or is that all just patterned, pre-patterned into our coding and our neural systems? Does that make sense, that question?
It does. And what I'm about to say may or may not feel like a cop-out. But I recall being a 18-year-old freshman, first semester, on the campus at Penn State. And I was in Psych 101 or 110 or whatever it was. And the argument around nature and nurture coming up, and then it would haunt me for the next 4 years as a psych major. And the answer is always yes, both. And so in terms of the equipment that we inherit, in terms of the way that our brains are wired and predisposed to be wired, we know that there are certain things that we inherit from previous generations. And then the patterns and what our environment is like and what we're reinforced for, particularly through our early years. But you know, in terms of brain neuroplasticity, we're still very plastic up until about 25. That what that hardware then evolves into over those 25 years really has much more to do with all of those other factors, the social interactions, the environmental interactions, the experiences that we have. And it's not to say that we can't change our brains after 25. It's just we have to be more purposeful about it. And so I think to answer your question, it's not that our traits and our genetics don't matter. I don't ever want to give somebody that impression. And I think we often underestimate the role that our past experience and then the choices that we are ready and prepared to make moving forward we underestimate the impact that those have. One of my favorite articles is called The Mundanity of Excellence. And the argument is essentially that becoming excellent isn't really as complicated as we make it. It's really not necessarily about genetics, that way more people are capable of performing at an Olympic level or performing at an elite musical level. It's that we often assume that it's genetics. Oh, I wasn't born that way, which is very fixed mindset. Or we're just not willing to act differently enough to actually cultivate that level of skill, particularly that level of skill under pressure, because it's profoundly uncomfortable to train at that level, but it's profoundly uncomfortable to continue to expose yourself to the pressure and stress of performance to reach that level, because you have to continue to move through it and you have to be willing to fail through that in order to reach that the peak of the mountain. And so I guess again, it may feel like a cop-out, but the answer is yes, it's both as far as I'm concerned.
Cool. That's really, it's just an eternally interesting thing to ponder. Okay, shifting gears totally and completely again. I have a question for you about practice and process and building practice procedures and how and when to change those procedures. Because something I run into as a practitioner myself and as a teacher and someone who helps people practice and prepare for performances is that there, when you're trying something new, when you're trying out a new process, you have to commit some time and consistency into that process, but then we're always tweaking the process. And it's hard for me to identify in myself and my students, at what point do you begin to tweak and at what point do you really need to commit and follow through with a process? Is that something that you experience in your world?
Yes, very much so. And it makes me think again of that article, The Mundanity of Excellence. And in the article, he talks about this idea that more is useful, whether it's more practice, more reps. It's useful within the band of performance that you're already in. So if you are a beginner, more effort is going to get you further up the ladder as a beginner, but that you are going to hit a ceiling at some point where you need to fundamentally and qualitatively change the way you're training in order to move from beginner to intermediate. And then within the context of intermediate, right, again, more volume is often going to help you get higher up. But then again, you're going to have to go into your chrysalis and then come out as a butterfly and qualitatively shift the way you engage your world to be elite. And so thinking about where those things happen and what are some of the behaviors that distinguish fundamentally somebody who's pretty good as an intermediate performer from somebody who's beginning to evolve into elite, and then how can we help students or the athletes that we engage make that jump. And you pointed to what could be very uncomfortable is like, if I'm doing a process that got me this far, why on earth would I abandon it for something that I don't have any guarantees is going to get me further? And this is the fundamental question when a runner changes their form and believes that it's going to make them more efficient and more economical, but they don't know for sure. A golfer changes their swing. And so there has to be a certain period in that transition where somebody's open to essentially sucking, right? Not being at the level they think they're capable of, with some faith and hopefully with some coaching that's helped triangulate the changes so that they can push through that period of sort of dysregulation and feeling like the wheels are off the bus, and then begin to, you know, start climbing that different path up the mountain that's going to give them access to a higher point up the peak.
Definitely.
And I guess, you know, I'm wondering how that tracks for you, since you have experience both as a elite performer and then certainly as a teacher of music.
It tracks well. It is a very consistent part of my thought process. And the empathy that I can offer is we brass players have to sometimes change our embouchure, where the lips come together into a focal point to produce a vibration. Because if there's an inefficiency, and oftentimes that inefficiency has something to do with the jaw setting or the amount of upper or lower lip that goes into the mouthpiece, there is a point when if it's like 90% lower lip and 10% upper lip, that is going to prevent certain students from, they will hit that ceiling. And so it'll prevent them from growing at a certain point, but up until this point they have grown, and you never really know how far somebody can go with what looks like it could be an inefficient embouchure. And then another example would be Louis Armstrong is a great, somebody who had a really inefficient embouchure, and he had to cancel gigs because certain parts of his lips, we call them chops, weren't functioning at a certain point. And I met someone, I had a professor in grad school who used to play with him. And and he at one point canceled a gig and then called the bandmaster up and said, "Hey, I can do the gig. I found a new piece of meat," meaning he moved his trumpet mouthpiece to different parts of his face. I mean, obviously on his lips always, but trying to find a new embouchure that could work where the muscle would actually do what he wanted it to do to make the sounds he wanted. And so there's an example of someone who was able to ascend over physical barriers because his musical and artistic mind was just enormously gifted. But when I see that in a student, I raise red flags, but it's really hard for me to know when to enforce an embouchure change, which, like you said, means committing to sucking for a certain while. And I had to go through this myself. I essentially had to take a year and a half off of the trumpet and rebuild. And I think it just has to be a point where you've heard enough, for my students at least, you've heard enough people say, this thing that you're doing is not going to serve you long term. And then you have to really have, it goes back to the trust thing, really trust your primary professor or mentor, and then trust yourself in what feels wrong, and then commit to the change and ask yourself if you're willing to commit to that change. Because I'm sure any golfer who's changed their swing and then has discovered the limitless potential with a new, more efficient swing, you know, then the ceiling is infinitely higher and it's amazing, but wow, what a daunting door or wall to hit.
When you point to the fact that physically, not every trumpet player's embouchure is going to look the same, and not every body position is going to be the same. Like we are built uniquely. And the same is true for athletes. There's all sorts of, this is the only way you can throw a baseball, or this is the only way that you can swing a golf club. And then you watch a bunch of people who excel anyway. And so I think that there's a certain wiggle room within the physical realm that says there's a lot of different ways to arrive at excellence. I think it's also true for the mental and emotional components. Right, but I'd be curious to pick on, what do you see from a practice and rehearsal standpoint that might distinguish somebody who's a very good intermediate but will never reach the level of elite because of some of those either mental habits or practice habits?
What I see in them?
Yeah, like, because I think it comes back to behaviors, and I classify thoughts as behaviors as well.
Yeah.
I guess we could reframe the question as, what are elite musicians doing and thinking that separate them from those people who maybe have the capacity to be there but aren't?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I want to ask you the same question. I think creating a sort of iceberg where there's been an enormous amount of thought put into each component of playing. I'm talking about the elite performers. But all of those components are hidden beneath the water. And then the tip of the iceberg is what shows up in a performance. And it's really allowing awareness for the most important ingredients. So part of the success of these elite performers is knowing what ingredients are important to them. There are certain things, like I mentioned in the last conversation we had, for all of us, wind and song is important. By us, I mean brass players. You know, if you use wind to make your sound, it's super important to efficiently use your breath in your body and turn that into sound. And then the music you hear in your head and translating that into the sound you produce into the space. But each of us is very different, and we have to sort of tailor a thought process or a removal of thoughts according to our needs. And the most amazing performers know when to narrow their buoys down to just three or four things to think about as they perform and play. And then the younger students or the amateurs that I see, they either cognitively, like you said, it's way over the 4%, and they haven't built the skill to be there, or they're trying to think about way too many things. And more importantly, their mental bandwidth is consumed far too much by what does everybody think about how I'm playing right now?
Yes. And so if I had to quick it down, awareness, and I don't know how to make this sound better, but just enough is enough, right? Enough thinking, but no more. Mm-hmm. And that those two pieces help distinguish someone who has has the level of performance that would distinguish them as elite, as opposed to someone who has the chops but isn't living up to that. They're not approaching their ceiling.
Yeah, that, and then also a creative expressive power in their head. You know, we don't have a sonic word for visualize. Visualize the sound and create the phrases in a way that is really special and unique to that one performer. That is the next level elitism for musicians, is you're creating your own sound and expressing it in your own way, in a way that nobody else has done before. That is, you know, like the tip of the iceberg when it comes to innovative, creative performing.
When I think, I heard, it was actually in the book, The Art of Learning by Josh Waitzkin. He defines peak performance as unobstructed self-expression. And it doesn't matter if you are an artist or an athlete or someone leading a Fortune 100 company. That would be true regardless. And so I love that for you, that's at the very top of the iceberg as well, because for the best performers, the best athletes that I've worked with, it's really about removing the impediment to unobstructed self-expression. Right? At that point, you have the capacity, you have the skills and tools. And so it's about allowing you to navigate the things that will actually put a crimp in the hose, as opposed to trying to expand the capacity of the hose so that more water can flow through it. Mm-hmm. I think if I consider the athletes that I've worked with, one of the big pieces of the puzzle comes down to how they engage their process. And specifically, in practice, how much of themselves are they bringing to the experience? Because I think that what you do the most of is what you do more of. And so if you only show up for part of practice, or you're physically there, but you're not mentally engaged, then what you're getting good at is, particularly, you're practicing in the context of your sport, what you're getting good at is being like half here and half someplace else. And so any of that sort of mindless or being on autopilot, and I separate autopilot from sort of the unconscious processing. If you're dribbling a basketball, you don't want to have to think about it. But for me, autopilot looks like if you were working on a ball handling drill, not really paying attention to or being with the experience of working on the ball handling as you're doing it, which would then enable you to be unconscious walking up the court and then breaking down a defender, if that makes sense. And so I think one of the biggest distinguishing factors of intermediates and then the folks who have the unlock the ability to climb into the next tier and begin to work their way up that elite level is that they're willing to invest the time and qualitatively be different. It's not that they're doing more practice. It's that the type of practice, the quality of themselves during the practice has been elevated. And so it's at a level of detail that many people are unwilling to do, or I guess unwilling or just not motivated. It's not worth it enough for them to spend the energy because it takes a tremendous amount of energy. And so for me, that's a really big one, is being in the front seat of your mind, not again, not overthinking, right? But being present to the experience and doing the hard work of being there as it's happening. And that makes really a wild, wild difference.
So we hear this a lot in the music world as well. The quality of your practice and being aware inside each layer of your practice, and putting in the enormous amount of energy that it takes to build a practice process. But let's say you're young, a budding performer or a budding athlete, and you know what the words quality practice mean, but you don't know what they mean to you. How do you start and build your quality practice if you don't really, you have the knowledge of what it means, but you don't have the wisdom yet?
It's a valuable distinction, those two. And I think that, you know, one of the refrains here has been to lean on what hopefully is a wise coach or wise teacher. Because somebody who's broken that trail before for themselves often can act as a guide and say, well, here are some of the things you might look for within your experience without being so structured as saying, this is the only thing that you will see as you emerge from beginner to intermediate and intermediate to expert. And I think the other piece is that it really comes down to elevating or expanding the scope of awareness. You know, building a more robust framework of meaning around what it looks like to be quality and engage in quality practice. So I think that the awareness building of asking questions around what are your purposeful targets? What are you actually trying to accomplish when you play this passage? And then how can we transition that and let it evolve? Because it may be at first the technical aspect. I'm just trying to get that under my fingers. And so, you know, with a metronome, I'm doing it very slowly. And then when I can do it right, I'm moving the metronome up so that I can eventually play it at the speed that it will be during a performance. But there's a whole other part that you've pointed to in now two conversations around adding the expressiveness and the emotionality and sort of the story that goes with that. And so if you're not practicing that, you're going to be technically proficient, but you're going to be incapable of bringing that to the table because that part of the quality hasn't emerged. And so I think that attentional quality is always the place to start. How much of yourself was here during that practice session? And if it comes down to it, like, we're not great at paying attention for more than 60 to 90 minutes at a time. And even then, there's going to be periods of time through that block where you're going to be more engaged, and then there's going to be periods where you're going to be less engaged. And so from a logistics standpoint, crafting practice so that you're not asking yourself to sit for 3 hours and practice at a high level, because eventually you're just going to be patterning frustration and poorer quality. So thinking about those and then really thinking about what do I need to do within the context of my practice structure that's going to allow me to unlock a very high level of focus with purpose, right? That presence and purpose together, so that I can get better at what I need to get better at today, so that I can transition into, you know, adding more emotion or telling a more compelling story or allowing myself to sound like me instead of trying to sound like somebody else. I don't know how I did though. Did I answer the question or did I turn it into a different question?
No, you did. And while you were talking, I was thinking about how, in a lot of ways, how simple the answer is, which is, well, what are your intentions? In what areas do you want to get better right now? Because I think a major wall that I hit when I was younger was, well, I want to be the best. I just want to be good at everything. And it's like, that's not a bite-sizable step. That's not a scaffolded approach. And so what I do, here's a tangible action step that I give my students. I have them come in and having identified problems in their music. This is a passage, it's a four measure passage that I cannot yet play. And I could see how this could translate to any other skill. And then I say, okay, so first identify your what and your why. What is the problem? And then why is that a problem? And what once they've done that with this small section of music, then I say, okay, well, now you know your what and your why. Now you have to build your how. So I'm going to have you put a timer on for 10 minutes. And I want you to pick a definable goal that you think you can accomplish in 10 minutes. And then when the timer goes off, you are done. And then I have them do that. And I have them pick an approach and a process. And the goal has to be so bite-sizable that they can actually accomplish it in that short period of time. And so maybe they're doing it at half tempo with all slurs, no tongue. And for those of you who aren't musicians, it just means you're not using consonants. And when the timer goes off, I ask, did you accomplish your goal? And if their answer is yes, 5 minutes ago, it's like, well, then you need to set a bigger goal. And if the answer is no, I didn't even get close, well, then your goals are way too lofty and you need to adjust the entirety of your practice session. And I think on a bigger picture, what this means, what it meant for me when I started doing these exercises and what it means for my students is you have to have an overall long-term vision, a big picture that you're driving towards, and then immediate next steps. And everything else is kind of like white noise, except for maybe milestones that you're looking towards. In defining the major vision, the directional milestones that you're aiming towards with your compass, and then your immediate next steps. If I can highlight those three things, I feel much better about the process than when I was young. I was trying to be, as you would say, crispy or crunchy and gritty in a bad way, about like all of the millions of steps I feel like I need to accomplish in order to be the best person in the whole world. And that was so ineffective for me.
That's a wrap. First off, thank you for listening. This project is a labor of love, and I hope you're enjoying these conversations as much as I am. An important note, everything you hear here reflects my own views and opinions and that of my guests, and has no relationship to any of my other professional roles or responsibilities. If you like this episode, make sure you subscribe to the show and don't forget to rate and leave a review. Also, if you want to dive deeper into the concepts and concrete practices from today, I'm talking about access to show notes and the transcript from the episode and a whole bunch of other mental training goodies, head over to mtl.academy. That's mtl.academy. Until next time, be well.